listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos, Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents I Wonder, the sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, August 21st, 2016.
So as those of you who have been here the last weeks know, I have been away on vacation, and I am copying the pattern that my husband, who is also a pastor, and several other colleagues have established for the week after vacation, and that is an instant sermon. Now, David, my husband, and my colleagues, Jennifer and Marisu, are very brave, and they just grab the questions and go. I haven't done this before, so I peeked. And I put them in some kind of order. So I'll ask you to pray for me while here we go. I won't be sticking as closely to my text as usual, and if it's appropriate at some point and you think I'm completely off the rails, shout it out. Feel free. So I thought I'd start with this question because I wanted to start with some certainty and clarity. And the question is, Coke or Pepsi? Duh, Coke. The second question is more serious. And the questioner says, I believe Scripture encourages us to live more simply, with less stuff. What are some ways we can support each other in living more simply, and how might this help our community? Well, I thought a lot about this question. It actually led me down many different paths as I thought about the stuff in my own life. Many of you know that several years ago, my father died. My mother had died several years before that. And my siblings and I went to our parents' home and cleared out 50 years of stuff. And my siblings and I each had different responses to that stuff and what we felt that we needed to take with us. For my brother, it was a small box of items that meant something to him, that resonated for him. For me, it was a little bit more. There were items that, not really of necessarily monetary value, but they were things, there were books that my mother had read with her notes in them. It was china that was my grandmother's. It's not valuable, but it's pretty to me. Just some things that resonated for me. And for my sister, it was important that nothing of my parents get left behind. And it's not that she is greedy. I don't mean to imply that at all. But for her, taking my parents' stuff was reassuring that we weren't letting them go. That if we let their stuff go, somehow we were abandoning them. It became very anxious for her to let things go. And eventually, she took many things to her home and stepped out of the process altogether because it was too painful. Our relationship with our stuff is fraught with many layers of meaning. And some of those layers are very positive. When I look across my living room, there's a small statue that my mother bought when we were young kids. Probably couldn't really afford it. We weren't a wealthy family. But it was very beautiful to her. And to have that in my living room reminds me of my mother and her love of beauty and her ability to create beauty. So that object is important to me, but it's just a thing. I don't need to have it. So my relationship with my stuff is complicated, as I'm sure everyone's is with their stuff. I also acknowledge that I have too much stuff. I've got books coming out my ears, and it's hard for me to let go of them because they're friends of mine, those books. And when I walk in a room and I see their spines, you know, I'm getting a little bit older, my memory's not perfect, but I remember that I read that book. I remember the author and the feeling that the book gave me. So I agree with the author of this question that our stuff can burden us, but it isn't a simple thing to let go of it. Our stuff also can be tools for us to create beauty, to create art, to create food. And when we were on the lake this summer, we have a neighbor on the lake who is extremely wealthy. And we've never really known him until this summer. We met at the funeral of another friend. There was a big dinner the night before. And he immediately took to my sons. And he lent them an ATV, and he lent them a Sea-Doo, and he gave them this, and he gave them that. And as they were packing things up, the boys noticed some water skis and said, oh, we were thinking of buying some water skis because my dad can teach us. He's good at it. And he said, don't buy them. Use mine. Our stuff can be a way of being really gracious and generous in the world. So this obviously has took me down many tracks, this question. But it's a good question about how we hold our stuff and what it would mean to share more of our stuff. One of the churches that I've been involved with in my life has a tradition of every 6 months or so, they have a bring. And people bring the things that they would like to release. And these are not necessarily hard-used things that really belong in a yard sale or at the dump. They're things that they just acknowledge that they don't really need and that somebody else in the community might need. And we practiced this for a number of years just among ourselves, and then we invited the neighborhood in. And it was amazing the benefit it was to the neighborhood, which was not a wealthy neighborhood. And people came and took things that they needed. You know, if I have six frying pans, I don't need them, but somebody might have none. So that's one way that I've seen this done. And I don't really know of others, of other ways of encouraging us to examine the stuff in our lives, to release the stuff we don't really need and we want to share joyously and generously with the world. Because it's almost impossible to evaluate somebody else's stuff. I don't know what has that deep resonance for you, what's meaningful, and what it's time for you to let go of. Only you know that. But it is something that I think we should continue to have dialogue about, and maybe even this idea of having a bring and take. Bring what you're ready to let go of. Take what you actually need. Someone asked the question, is it possible to be grounded in a deep sense of right and wrong without believing in God? And my first really glib answer to this is, well, of course, millions of Buddhists do it every day. And moreover, many of us who do believe in God can't even agree on what is right or wrong. But I don't mean that glibly. I mean, just so you know, I do know my religions. Some Buddhists believe in God and some don't. But I do believe that we are all made in the image of God. Every one of us, all of us, each of us, even those who don't believe in God. And so that deeply inside of us, we do have a sense of what is right and what is wrong. That's part of being made in the image of God. Unfortunately, we're also really frail, and we mess up, and we tend to be prey to things that build up our ego. And so we lose the thread of what's right and wrong, which is why I think it's so important to be in intentional community with other people, to stay on the track of what's right and wrong, to have people who care about you, who can nudge you gently or speak to you bluntly. And it's important that community be one with some tradition and some connection, because communities change and life is scary, and we're confronted with lots of technology and new ways of doing things. And it's important, I think, to have tradition to lean on as we figure out going forward what's the right thing to do with technology, what's the right thing to do with these new kind of moral issues that are arising. This fourth one is one I enjoy. Why did I become a pastor? And the short answer is, I became a pastor because I was an instructor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. I taught women in religion and American religious history, and I loved it. And I think I was pretty good at it. But what I really loved was when my students would come to me for pastoral care. And they came often because there were several chaplains on campus. There was a Catholic chaplain, there was a Buddhist chaplain, and there were several fundamentalist and or evangelical chaplains. But there was no progressive Christian voice on campus. And so when my students discovered that it was okay to doubt things and to question and to be angry, they came often to my office. And that to me was the most fun part of my job. It really woke me up. And so when we left Colorado, I didn't seek a job in the academic world for lots of reasons. I didn't want to talk about religion in an academic sense where we were separated from the practice of it. I wanted to help people find their spirit, not talk about other people finding their spirit, if that makes any sense. So the fifth question, somebody asked, I lay at night to rest and prayer starts, but I'm asleep before Amen. What's your recommendation to influence more attentive and intentional prayer habits? And the first thing I want to say is, if you fall asleep while you're praying at night, give thanks. The insomniacs among us are envious. But seriously, be grateful that you pray yourself to sleep. What a beautiful way to end your day, safe and loved. And if whoever you are, if you're here today, if you are seeking a deeper sense of God's presence, set aside other time to pray. And that's the short answer is develop a habit. So put a timer on your smartphone if you have to. Build it into your schedule for your day, but create a time for yourself when no one is allowed to distract you. If you have children at home, make it a time when your spouse or partner or some other person in your family can be responsible for the children. If you're a person who works 12 hours a day, take 20 minutes of that time and say, no, I'm not working. I'm going to go pray. Give yourself that gift. If it feels enticing to you, explore various prayer methods. Meditation, contemplative prayer. You can use the Lord's Prayer, as I know some of you have done. That was something, an invitation I made to the congregation. Has anyone actually followed up on that, using the Lord's Prayer several times a day? All right, I need to pound the pulpit more. I'll invite you again to try that practice. Memorizing favorite psalms or hymns. One form of prayer that I especially like is praying while running or walking. Now, you have to be in enough physical shape that you can let go of your hamster mind and you're not just feeling your muscles, that you're in that space of being active but relaxed. And that, to me, I'm not a person who sits still, you may have noticed, very well. So walking and running prayer can be a beautiful space for me to be in touch with my spirit. But the key to any of those is to do it as a practice. Now, having said that, it doesn't have to be rigid. You're not trying to score any points or impress God. God already loves you. The practice of prayer is to open your heart to experience God's love, not to earn that love. And perhaps what you're looking for is strength or wisdom or joy. When you develop that practice, there's a place to constantly go back to. Another thing that sometimes happens for people who have an active practice of a prayer life is that sometimes the practice that is for such a long time nurturing to you suddenly becomes like dust. And so I know for myself, I used to run almost every day, and running was the place where I most consistently could be in touch with my spirit and feel God's presence with me. And then for a while, nothing worked right. I just felt grumpy, and I didn't want to go, and I didn't feel anything but annoyed. But I kept showing up, because that's the secret, to keep showing up. Unless it isn't. Sometimes it's okay to drop a prayer practice that's no longer working for you. Because prayer is meant to help your spirit, not to earn points. Does anyone else have a recommendation for prayer practice and making it a more intentional part of your life?
For the fun of it, to attempt a prayer of praise, I took different lines together of different prayers, the first line, and then I put them together in a prayer. So sometimes, even if you have a hard time coming up with your own prayer, taking what's already there and rearranging it can still be a spot of creativity. And I think that creativity is a prayer.
Nice.
Surprise, surprise. My prayer activity comes mostly through music. But I find myself, every time I'm humming a melody of a hymn or something, and I realize that it's a hymn, I sort of just stop and think about why that is in my life at the moment.
Nice.
And it's weird because it's the won't you let me be your servant, has been stuck in my head for like a month. So every time I go, okay, I'll be your servant, I don't know, whatever. But so just, I've been finding those times to like have intentional like understandings of what my brain is doing, because most of the time I have no idea what's going on.
Every time I am out and there is a fire engine that goes by or a policeman that goes by with their sirens on, I always say a prayer for those receiving help and those giving help.
No, it's lovely. Yeah.
Well, when I can't sleep at night, I think of the old song, Count Your Blessings, name them one by one, and that helps me a great deal.
Sweet. Did everyone hear that? No?
She, when she's in bed at night and she can't sleep, she remembers that song, Count Your Blessings One by One. She starts to count her blessings.
And she does that. She does that.
The kind of prayer I've been doing for years off and on, or quite a lot, is centering prayer. And very often I get to the end of the prayer period and go, well, nothing happened. It's really boring. But lately, many times during the day, I will check myself and say, how did you just react? When your grandchild was just being really naughty, how were you reacting? Were you peaceful inside? This is the examination of the fruits of that silent or quiet time.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
There's a practice that I've used off and on over the years called ACTS, A-C-T-S. And it's sort of a guide for your prayers. So it starts with adoration, which I didn't incorporate into my prayers until I came across this. But it's a really great way to start a prayer, just glorifying God, adoring God. C is for confession, T is for thanksgiving, and S is for supplication. And it's also good to remember that the supplication should come at the end.
For many years, I had a set aside time that was my quiet time, starting from the time I could read the Bible, probably, all the way up through the time I got married, I guess. And then that became harder to set aside that time. Excuse me. And gradually, my devotional time became more porous. And with me throughout the day, the red lights provided the time. Washing dishes provided the time. Some of my best devotional moments have been in that porous time. I'm not sure that I recommend this. It may be a confession, but it is the way my devotional life works for me.
And it sounds, Jeanette, like that may be because you had so many years of intentionality behind it that it became constant for you.
And I have to say that I have learned so much about prayer from praying with other people, mm-hmm. For having regular prayer times with one person or with a group.
It seems like praying is, for me at least, a way to connect with God. And so there are many ways to do that that aren't in the strict definition of prayer. When my father died, we got the call to come to where he was living. And when we got there, we walked in the room, and I really think he had just died, just from the color of, or lack of color of his skin, etc. But it didn't bother me because I felt like the angels were there. And God's presence was there, and my father knew that we had come.
I just want to reaffirm Ian's comments earlier, at least for me. Whenever I feel I'm in the need of prayer, typically I'll go upstairs, turn on my karaoke system where I have 40,000 songs, and I'll pick one of those songs, okay, that's meaningful to me.
Along that line, every morning I turn on the Circle of Life from the Lion King, And I just love the words, and it just makes me feel so holy and surrounded in love by everything on earth.
I pray in the shower. I can't say that I'm not interrupted in the shower, because I'm constantly interrupted in the shower. Constantly. But that's my prayer closet.
What has helped me is the word persistence, stick-to-itiveness. And people have said, well, gee, my answer came 10 years after I prayed my prayer for help, but I could not see it. So those that share their darkest times of doubt, but stay with the program, will be victorious.
I pray with a song, Amazing Grace comes to my mind, but also one that, a prayer time that's a little different. You remember that, well, maybe you don't remember, but my wife died a year ago, April 16th, and I don't know where it's written, but men are supposed to die first, but she didn't get the memo, I guess. Anyway, I felt very alone, and not only her absence, but where's God in all this? And then I remember a song that come to my memory. I don't know the number, but it goes like this. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or how can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, thou art there. And if I make my bed in hell, behold, thou also art there. And if I take the wings of the morning and I dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thou shalt lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. And if I say, surely the darkness will cover me, then even the night shall be light about me. For the darkness hideth not from thee, but shines as the noonday. For the darkness and the light are both alike to thee. Amen.
Amen indeed. Thank you for all of that sharing. That was really beautiful. I don't think I'm going to get to all of these questions. I'm going to skip number 7, which is, what are the differences in belief between Christian denominations and what do they have in common? Because I could talk for a whole semester about that, and I really would love to. In fact, when I was teaching a confirmation class, we were talking about the Protestant Reformation, and I was, you know, very excitedly talking about church history, and one of my youth group kids said, "You're a giant nerd. I thought you were cool. I'm so glad you're a nerd like me." So we'll skip that one, but we will come. I'll come back to it. Yes, absolutely. Number 6. This is also a difficult question. The question is how to handle blame, not to blame oneself or others or God, especially when one sees God as being our all-powerful Creator. This is an excellent question and one that I live with myself. Blame and shame have for so long been used as tools to coerce our behavior and our belief that it seems almost second nature to us. It becomes reflexive. And I know I catch myself blaming the people I love most pretty frequently. So here's a not very nice story about me. David and I split the housework in the house. I do most of the grocery shopping and the cooking, and David does almost all of the laundry. And about 2 years ago, he was doing the laundry like he did, and he gathered it up, and he sorted it, and washed it, and put it in the dryer, and he folded it, and then he left it in piles, festooning the family room. And this drove me out of my mind, and I made up all kinds of stories in my mind about why he was doing this. What kind of passive-aggressive message was he trying to send to me? Did he think that I should really be doing the laundry? Was he annoyed with me? Well, I'm annoyed back. And there was a huge story going on in my head. And so I said to him one day, with a lot of heat in my voice, "Why do you do that?" And he said, Because the laundry basket has gone missing. There was no story. There was no passive-aggressive message underneath. He just couldn't find the laundry basket. And let the record show that I had borrowed the laundry basket, and it was in the back of the car filled with stuff for a retreat. Blaming other people for the things that make us uncomfortable is a bit of an addiction, but I do believe it's an addiction that we can break. And the first thing to do is to detach from all of that emotional baggage that we've put onto a simple thing like the laundry. And in the words of the Buddhist nun Pema Chodron, drop the storyline. That's a phrase that I use frequently. Drop your storyline and ask some open-ended questions. I've been reading a Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication, for a sermon series I'm planning for this fall. And I'll, just as a way of, by way of preview, he talks about when you are in conflict with another person, taking four steps. The first one is to observe the concrete actions of another person, not our story about them, but the concrete actions that are affecting our well-being. Next, to notice how we feel about what we observe, and then to identify the needs, the values, or the desires that create our feelings. And finally, to make a request for a different concrete action from the other person. Now this, of course, presupposes that the other person wants to come to resolution with you. And they are very good steps, and I'll talk much more about that this fall. But then there are other situations in our lives where someone has been to blame and has harmed us. And I think it is not wrong to assign responsibility to another person for an action that they've taken that has harmed us. And if that person has no regret and no intention of changing their behavior, I think the wise thing to do is to remove yourself from that situation, to take responsibility for your own self going forward, and as much as is possible, to release that person. And again, to drop the storyline about why they did what they did. You may be right, but you may be completely wrong. So, insofar as possible, drop the storyline, and that will help you move away from blame and shame. The question of not blaming God is an even harder one. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church and spent a lot of time as a youth memorizing the Westminster Shorter Catechism. And let me say, if that's the shorter one, I don't want to know the longer one. And actually, the only part I still have memorized, excuse the exclusive languages, what is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. I don't disagree. But the other thing I learned from the Westminster Shorter Catechism is that God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. In other words, all-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere present at the same time, and wholly good. And I still believe that, except for when I can't. Because it makes no sense that such a God would allow the kinds of things that happen here on earth. The attempt to answer this question of how a good God can allow such evil to happen is an ancient question. The word theodicy got attached to it in, I think, the 18th century, but it goes way back to Irenaeus and Augustine and the fathers of the church, and it's a question that's taken up in every religion. And I won't go into, I had all kinds of notes about what Irenaeus said and what Augustine said. I won't go into any of that. I will say that I don't have an intellectual answer for how it can be that these things coexist, a good God and evil in the world. I find myself going back to the same thing that I go back to when thinking about blaming other people, and that is to rest in the relationship. To drop our storyline and rest in the relationship that we already have with God and that we trust. Before we get there, before we get to resting in that relationship, I think it's perfectly okay to say out loud to God all of the angry feelings we have. I think it's okay to rail and argue and say things that verge on the blasphemous. Anne Lamott has a wonderful scene in one of her early books where a young teenager comes upon her very devout mother, who is out in the yard, screaming at God and saying words I can't say here in church. She calls him nasty names. And I think that God can take it. God can accept our anger and our confusion and our blaming, as long as we don't stop there. As long as when we have worn ourselves out with our fighting words, we sit and listen. And my experience of times in life when I have railed against God is that when I am done, when I have worn myself out, like a toddler who has screamed and yelled, I find myself in the presence of someone. Not something, but someone. And it is there in that still, small voice after the storm that I am assured of God's continuing presence and love. I don't have an intellectual answer, I only have an experiential answer to that question. I want to look at the time before I open that one up to other people's experience, because that's a huge question. And for those of you who have more questions about that and who want to delve into it, that is one of the things we will talk about in our theology distilled group that will start meeting next month. So we'll save that for a more face-to-face time. Question number 8, who wrote the Lord's Prayer? Probably the Lord. There are two versions of the Lord's Prayer in the New Testament, in Luke and Matthew. They're in very different situations, and they're slightly different from each other. So one could make the argument that the version that's in Luke is to be preferred. But because they come in such different situations, the one in Matthew, Jesus is in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, one could also argue that Jesus taught it several times. I think he probably repeated himself. I know that Mark, in particular, points out how stubborn and dunderheaded the disciples were, so I think he probably had to repeat himself. So my short answer is Jesus, which my Sunday school students always said was always the answer, no matter what the question. And finally, the last question, because we started with certainty, and I think we should end with mystery. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know.
Listen, listen, listen.